From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We have a long list of stuff to go through since we've last spoken, of course. So I guess we can start with the overview from ECLAC.
The UN body, the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, and I haven't looked at their most recent publication over the last couple of days, but a little over a week ago, they published a report suggesting that their prediction is that Latin America for the rest of the year is probably facing over 9% contraction in the overall regional economy. And that, as you said, is a population of about 655 million people.
Yeah.
And they reckon that there's going to be an increase in poverty of 37%, which means that 231 million people will be living in poverty as they define it. So that's over a third of the region's population will be living in poverty.
Jesus.
And they reckon that 15% of the population, which is equivalent to 98 million people, will be living in extreme poverty. Basically, all of them will be facing starvation.
It's like almost 100 million people.
Yeah, almost 100 million people. And so they're trying to raise the alarm and trying to mobilize policy and opinion in order to address that catastrophic situation, because I don't think there's any other way to describe that.
Well.
And after, I know a long period up until about 2013-2014 in which the governments in the region were prioritizing a reduction in poverty and the fight against poverty, and that's all kind of been lost, and we're back to the situation that prevailed in the late 1990s when poverty was rampant in Latin America.
Yeah.
And so that's a very depressing situation.
And it seems like those places where it's been most successfully addressed and where the resources have been marshaled by the government of the, particular group of people, that those are the people that are most targeted by the United States. And this isn't just Trump. This is since 1823, since, Monroe.
Oh, yeah, sure.
In the 21st century, today, the Monroe Doctrine includes 100 million people facing starvation. That's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, and there's so much to say about that. The determination of the United States to impose oil across the region is a direct cause of that dreadful situation. It's not just the virus, right?
And
the different countries have responded in different ways to the virus. And here in Nicaragua, the government has demonstrated that it's perfectly possible to maintain education especially for the most vulnerable low-income families. They demonstrated that it's possible for the economy to keep functioning to the extent that in the first quarter of the year, again, ECLAC, the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, has in economic statistics for the region, has pointed out that Nicaragua increased its exports in the first quarter of this year by 14%, and that's up to the end of May. Whereas every other country in the region suffered a contraction in their exports, except a couple of other countries here in Central America that had increases in their exports of something like 1 or 2%. But Nicaragua has demonstrated that it is possible to address the virus because they have one of the best records across the region.
Right.
In addressing the virus, they have a very low number of both cases and deaths compared to their neighbors. And so it's not the case that the virus is a reason in itself why the region is facing this catastrophic economic situation over the next year or so. And it has a lot to do with the responses of different governments to the crisis. And if you look at Cuba and if you look at Venezuela, which are the other two progressive countries in the region that have addressed the pandemic in a way that protects their population, their economies are functioning okay. You know, they've been able to manage the difficulty of what to do about education okay. And the countries that have either right-wing governments or centre-right governments, and at this stage I categorise the government of Argentina as basically a centre-right government because it's difficult to see how their policies are actually going to protect people from the worst effects of the crisis that ECLAC is signalling.
Right.
And if you look at Argentina, they've reached this deal on debt with their creditors. What does that mean? It means that they're going to assign a huge chunk of their resources, their governmental resources, to repaying what is essentially odious debt that was incurred by the previous irresponsible right-wing neoliberal administration. So, and then if you look at other countries throughout the region, in Peru, Ecuador, they've made terrible responses to. To addressing the pandemic. And why have they made those terrible responses? Because they have decided to subjugate themselves to the will of the United States and United States policy across the region. And so it's absolutely clear that a corollary of Mike Pompeo's determination and the determination of his predecessors to reimpose the Monroe Doctrine, essentially trying to address the challenge of China and address the challenge of Russia in terms of influence in the region. And that determination has led directly to this catastrophic economic situation and the catastrophic failure of right-wing and centre-right governments to protect their peoples from the effects of this admittedly very serious pandemic. But I mean, if a tiny impoverished country like Nicaragua can address it satisfactorily protecting their population, if Venezuela and Cuba can, that have been subject to the most vicious sanctions from on the part of the United States and also on the part of the United States poodles in the European Union. And why, you know, what? Look at that contrast. What does it tell you about the validity of the respective set of policies, socialist policies, revolutionary policies, progressive policies, against the failed reactionary neoliberal, oh, let's leave everything to market policies? You know, it's just obvious to anybody with looking at it in any way, in any impartial way.
You know, if you look 3 months after Macri took office, he, you know, in March of 2016, he handed over, 2.4 billion, I think, some huge chunk of money to the United States that ended up going to Paul Singer and the vulture funds that had been, you know, discounted. It was like, you know, tossed aside in the bankruptcy and restructuring of Argentina's finances years before. These guys at the hedge fund bought the paper that had been defaulted on for pennies, anticipating like a 0% chance that anyone was going to recover any money on it. And instead, they pulled billions of dollars out of Argentina after Macri snuck into the presidential palace. And then what happens, of course, is that money was never budgeted for, and it was discharged. It was so onerous. And so what it meant was a few billion dollars got ripped out of Argentina's treasury at the very beginning of Macri's time in office, and that money came out of the pockets of everybody else in the society who were looking for health care, food subsidies, housing subsidies, or whatever, where they instead slid further down the ladder into poverty and extreme poverty, while Singer picked up a few billion dollars.
Yeah, and when in order to address the financial fiscal deficits that resulted from that decision by Macri, they ended up taking a record-sized loans from the IMF, unprecedented,
right,
of well over $50 billion.
Right.
You know, what was that money for? Was that money to help the Argentinian people? Of course it wasn't. That money was to help the Argentinian government and financial system meet its credit liabilities overseas.
Right.
And also its credit liabilities to the oligarchs inside Argentina.
Right.
And so that's what the IMF money was for.
Right.
So when, as a matter of course, as obviously they were going to do, Alberto Fernandez and Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner won the election against Mauricio Macri's re-election attempt. What did they inherit? They inherited a situation where I just don't see how it's going to be possible for them to meet the needs of Argentina's people and protect the most vulnerable sectors of Argentina's population. I just don't see how they're going to do it. Yeah. And who knows what that means politically. But we'll see. I mean, they may be able to put together some kind of package that protects the most vulnerable, but I just don't see how they're going to do it. So then, you know, let's see what happens in Argentina. One of the interesting things about Alberto Fernandez is that, apart from all his domestic difficulties, and you may remember that last time we were talking, that we mentioned the kinds of internal contradictions between Alberto Fernandez in the presidency and his foreign ministry team over Venezuela. Well, it looks like the government there, President Alberto Fernandez, seems to have resolved the indecision about what was going to be Argentina's policy in regard to Venezuela. And they've now recognized the Venezuelan electoral process. And that, and if you look at that in the context of other things that have been happening, you now have the Lima group of the right-wing countries that had previously been very hard-line, rejecting any attempt by President Nicolas Maduro to stabilize things in Venezuela. And now you have Mexico has now left the Lima group, and the new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, recognizes the Venezuelan electoral process. Argentina has now effectively not formally withdrawn from the Lima group, but they too are following the Mexican line. They're recognizing the Venezuelan elections. You now have the European Union no longer recognizing the usurper president imposed by the United States, Juan Guaido. And even the Lima group itself has dropped its recognition of Juan Guaido as the Venezuelan president. Now, as well as all that that's been going on, internally, there's been quite a strong sea change, if you like, in the way that the Venezuelan opposition is trying to regroup and decide what to do about the elections. And so you have a very strong body of the right-wing Venezuelan opposition agreeing to take part in the elections. In fact, in the elections, there are going to be a total of 17 political parties taking part. I think they're scheduled for December the 6th currently. Within that internal electoral kind of kaleidoscope, what you now have is even Henry Capriles, who was the defeated electoral candidate back in 2013 in the elections after the death of Comandante Eterno Hugo Chavez Frias, and even he now has split from Leopoldo López, who's currently holed up in the Spanish embassy, and Leopoldo López would be, if he were free and if under normal conditions, he would probably be a leading opposition candidate to lead some opposition right. coalition on behalf of the United States. But now you have a situation where the United States doesn't want to represent the elections. One of the leading opposition politicians, Henry Capriles, has decided that he will recognize the elections. The Venezuelan bishops, in Venezuela fulfill a very similar role to the role that the bishops fulfilled here in Nicaragua, extremely right-wing, very supportive of United States policies against the government. Even the Venezuelan bishops have now recognized the electoral process and are calling on Venezuelans to take part in the elections. So what does that mean? I mean, internally in Venezuela and in regionally, it's a strong defeat for the United States attempts to completely marginalize and ostracize and turn into some kind of regional pariah the government of President Nicolas Maduro. And Nicolas Maduro has been very astute, and he's followed the example that President Daniel Ortega followed, or set rather, back in 2019, when Daniel Ortega took the extremely difficult decision to pardon the murderers and torturers and extortionists and gangsters that had operated the failed attempted coup against his government back in April, July 2018.
Right.
And that decision has turned out to be a key decision in stabilizing Nicaragua. Now, Nicolas Maduro has taken a similar decision. He's taken the decision to issue pardons. Sometimes not complete pardons, sometimes just saying, right, well, we won't keep you in jail anymore, we'll put you under house arrest. But he's actually issued pardons to 110 opposition figures who are in jail for various offences committed through 2017 in particular, during the different coup attempts that have been attempted by the Venezuelan opposition over the last 2, 3, 4 years. Now, that decision to pardon those opposition figures, many of whom are very active and even political leaders of the opposition, that too has caused tremendous disruption into the Venezuelan opposition. It's a very cute tactical move, but also a very sensitive strategic move, because tactically it throws the Venezuelan opposition into deeper disarray as they try and assimilate new voices that had previously been out of action because they were in jail. But also internationally, it adds to the difficulties of the United States in that by issuing those pardons, what Maduro has actually achieved is that he's made it much easier for the European Union to take a decision to perhaps not just abandon Guaido, but to actually recognize the electoral process in Venezuela. And if that happens, they haven't done it formally. Joseph Borrell, I think he's the EU foreign spokesperson, has welcomed the decision and regards it as a positive decision towards enabling a normalization of relations between the European Union and the government of President Maduro. But I think you yourself have pointed out to me that this kind of measure on the part of the European Union, if you look at it in the global context of how international relations are shaping up, and we need to add that to the differences between the European Union and the United States over Iran, over the nuclear agreement. Right. We need to add it to the differences between the United States and Germany over the Nord Stream
right.
Project. Who knows what's actually going to happen about that, given the Navalny affair. But and as things stand, Germany is going to go ahead with the Nord Stream 2 project. And so now you have this also another difference between the EU and the United States in their policy over Venezuela.
You know, there's another inside of that, by the way. Interrupt for a second, but on this, it's on the same point. You know, there's also the EU's, you know, sort of Me Too sanctions regimes that, you know, part of what Venezuela has to face, of course, is, you know, trying to be isolated from the world's goods and services. The U.S. has been conducting that kind of a policy against them pretty aggressively, and the EU has chimed in a lot. Now, the thing about that is that rather than there being one giant sanctions law that was crafted, all-encompassing, and passed at the UN, there are these piecemeal things that are responses to immediate or intermediate acts that are taken by the Venezuelan government. Completely illegal. But in terms of politics, when, for example, there were arrests after the last coup attempt, there's a declaration by Washington that this is an anti-democratic move to arrest these legitimate politicians for expressing legitimate dissent. Bam, these sanctions go on. And then, bam, the EU follows up on them. Well, suddenly, you know, aren't these pardons the consideration for a lifting of those kinds of sanctions? And aren't they at least political cover for it?
Oh, yeah, I'm very, very much so. And it remains to... It remains to be seen how that's going to develop, Don.
Of course, yeah, right.
Because nobody can trust the EU. They're somewhat agreement capable, I think, is the phrase that the Russians use regard to the United States. Right. The United States is simply not agreement capable.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And you can apply that to the EU to some extent as well. So whereas there's undoubtedly a whole series of negotiations going on, because I read an article the other day in relation to the move by Capriles that pointed out that essentially what Capriles is doing is taking up the negotiation process that had been promoted by, in particular by Norway, that had been taking place in the island nation of Barbados. And Capriles seems to have taken that up again. And that is, you know, if that happens, and obviously what he's jockeying for is to become the undisputed leader of the Venezuelan opposition by reactivating that ideological negotiating position of being prepared to dialogue with President Maduro within that Norwegian promoted framework. Well, that in itself is going to give cover to the EU if they want if they do decide that they're interested in relaxing the sanctions against Venezuela. Another thing, Don, I don't know if we've got time to talk about it,
another thing that has happened
that indicates the weakness of the United States, despite its determination, its desperation to reimpose the Monroe Doctrine in the crudest possible way, and Mike Pompeo is the embodiment of that. And he recently visited regional countries in Panama, for example. I think they went to Colombia, which is a complete train wreck in terms of just about everything. And there he was with the head of Southern Command telling the Panamanians what to do and what not to do.
Right.
And so, but in response to that, it may seem an insignificant detail, but I think it's significant. And there's this election coming up in the Inter-American Development Bank, and the candidate for the United States is a guy called Mauricio Claver Caroni. Now, you'd think that would be a relatively unimportant thing, but what they're doing is, what Pompeo and his team are doing is overturning decades of precedent whereby the president of the Inter-American Bank is always a Latin American. And it's the vice president that the United States have tended always to have the right to nominate.
Right.
So what has happened as a result of that change in U.S. policy, this attempt to impose their will? Even right-wing government, even Laura Chinchilla, the center-right former president of Costa Rica, has resigned in disgust, and she's dropped her candidacy. She's withdrawn from the election and very publicly said, I'm withdrawing from this election because I'm disgusted with the United States for trying to impose its will against the established practice, the established precedent of 40, 50 years, ever since the Inter-American Bank was founded. And you even get people like center-right social democrat Ricardo Lagos, the former Chilean president, and he's very much in the mold of Michelle Bachelet, a center-right social democrat. And even he has written articles explaining why this is a dreadful precedent on the part of the United States.
Yeah, it goes something like this. See, I expected to be elected president of the bank myself and get my instructions from the vice president appointed by the United States, but it's a really good paying job, and at least somebody in this hemisphere ought to get a really good paying job. Why not me?
Well, that's one way of looking at it.
It's the Quislings look at it, yeah.
Perhaps I'm a little bit less cynical, and I think it's just a straw in the wind, maybe. But it indicates something very significant.
Yeah.
Even the U.S. right wing partners in the region, like Lara Chinchi and Ricardo Lagos, feel free to criticize the United States when, under other circumstances, they just keep stum.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to read what's going on with the U.S. in policy towards Latin America if you're looking in conventional ways, because, you know, you had Trump basically hired every moron in the sandbox to come play in this, the most, you know, the scariest, the most out of date, the most thoroughly trounced by history to this point, and yet, you know, the up front and center, you ended up with Bolton and Abrams and now Pompeo also has in state. You know, these guys, Pompeo's new to this, but the other two, you know, they really are the symbols of what the policy is about. A virtual president, the first time the U.S. has ever said, that guy over there, well, you can't see him, he's on the other side of that wall, he's hiding, but he's your president now. And then the only thing the guy's really good for is like a routing number for electronic fund transfers out of Venezuela's bank accounts into his, and I assume, you know, whoever it is around him that's working. Maybe Capriles, for example, is going to start getting the checks now.
Right. So, yeah, and there's so much to say about that, isn't there? But it seems to me there are two or three key contests going on in the region at the moment, and one of them is Venezuela, of course. Another is Ecuador, and in Ecuador, what seems to be happening is do we have time to talk about this, Don?
Yeah, we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay, well, I'm just quickly in Ecuador. What's happened is that despite all the official attempts to smear him for one false accusation after another by the Ecuadorian authorities, instigated, of course, by Lenin Moreno, the president, the turncoat president, and that Rafael Correa has managed to work with his colleagues inside. He's based in Belgium at the moment.
Right.
But he managed to work with his colleagues inside Ecuador to set up a coalition called the Union for Hope, La Unión por la Esperanza, which includes two or three different political groupings. But he's trying to register his candidacy for the vice presidency, and one adverse decision after another has been overcome, and they now face one final hurdle, and it's possible that his candidacy may be accepted or it may not be. The candidate for that movement is a young economist, somewhat similar in his profile at his age to Rafael Correa when Rafael Correa was in his early 30s, a guy called Andres Arauz. So it's an open question whether Rafael Correa's candidacy will be accepted. But the elections in Ecuador are early next year. I think they're in something like April or May next year.
Yeah, so we're going to have to watch that
Yeah, the way things are going, it's difficult to see how Andres Arauz can lose, even if Rafael Correa isn't his vice president candidate.
Okay. Like I said, we'll see. Thank you so much for your time, as usual, and we'll speak with you again real soon.
Thanks a million, Don. I look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York,
Thanks for listening.